skins and their cans.
Excellent. Ritzy, how are you?
Yes. Hey, Carmine.
Happy New Year.
Oh, my God. And happy Chinese New Year as well.
Absolutely.
It is.
Yeah.
Excellent.
It is.
So here we sit in Building 6 today with Molly Cox.
All right.
Thank you for having us here.
No problem.
Let's start with what group you're in, what your job is here at Microsoft.
Sure, I'm in the MSIT Service Management Division, and I am the service owner for the Microsoft.com team. So it's the folks that run the operations behind the www.microsoft.com website.
So what does that mean? What does that really
mean? That's a good question. What does it mean? It means that there's a lot of infrastructure and publishing engines and applications that go behind making the www.microsoft.com page available. And my team is the one that runs it. And there's three different things that they do. One is they host a lot of content out on it. They also there's a group of folks in servers and tools that do Windows updates, the ones that they push out, and then the download center for all the bits that people come to download from Microsoft.
Wow. So that's a big job. I think, I don't know if my stats are current or accurate, that Microsoft.com is like the fourth largest website in the world.
It is indeed.
So that's we're talking about a huge responsibility that you and your team have.
Absolutely, and the team is phenomenal. This is a really highly capable group of engineers and operation analysts. And I got to tell you, they are spot on, and they really know their business.
So being one of the busiest websites in the world, you must know a lot about uptime and availability and reliability. I mean, you must live that.
Well, I do live that, and I'd like to think I live that, but I've been in this role for all of 3 or 4 weeks. Prior to this, I spent a year stint working as Jim Dubois' chief of staff.
Okay.
So it's been a more recent change.
And Jim Dubois is a VP here at Microsoft?
He's a general manager in IT. He reports to the CIO, Tony Scott.
Got it. Okay. Well, new job, new gig.
Absolutely.
But that's interesting. How long have you been at Microsoft?
I've been here, it'll be 11 years in March.
And what job number is this, do you know?
Oh gosh, I can't count. I think in IT it's probably my fifth or sixth.
So I always love to point that out in these interviews that we do, that people know when they come, if they're interested in working at Microsoft, that there's lots of opportunity. You're not stuck in one job for 20 years.
Absolutely.
You can really explore your skill set and what your passions are and do lots of things. What are some of the things that you've done at Microsoft in your tenure?
So one of the areas I'm particularly passionate about is customer support, and that's where I came to the company. And then I moved into the MSN product group, and I've done operations, a lot of operations support. I've done product planning. I've done marketing. I've done strategic planning. I've done business management. And then I've done chief of staff and now service owner. So many roles.
So even though you can be at Microsoft for more than a decade, you can still keep learning and taking on new challenges and not be bored with what you do, right?
You know, I think that that is one of my core tenets and one of the things that I think about as a manager, which is fundamentally the high-performing teams are high-performing because they are learning organizations. And so how do you think about developing an atmosphere and an environment where your organization really does understand how to learn and how to use that as a tool? So, you know, learning and growing is the competitive advantage here.
Right. Versus complacency.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about your background, going back before you joined Microsoft, a little bit about your school and your education and...
Wow. How far back do you want me to go?
Well, what did you major in college?
Okay. Well, I majored in political science and economics. I graduated from the University of Washington. I am a native Seattleite. Yes, we do exist. Yes. My father moved us here right before I was born to work at the University of Washington. He was an environmental scientist there for 40 years.
Cool.
So my father obviously was well-educated, and as a scientist, we talked about the academic world a lot. And my mother had a master's degree, which was a little bit unusual for her generation. So we were born and raised with the idea that we would be going to college and pursuing some sort of career.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was in a big, huge hurry to grow up, so I got married. And my first job out of college was as a broker, if you can imagine. And my big, huge hurry didn't end up in all that much success. So I was in my very early 20s with a two-year-old. And I was looking for a job because I needed to take care of my baby.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up at Nordstrom, and I was at Nordstrom for 13 years.
Hmm.
And it really was quite a contrast to Microsoft. So after 13 years at Nordstrom's in IT, I then ended up working for a year as a consultant in call center services, and that's what brought me here.
Hmm. And so how are Nordstrom and Microsoft different?
Well, it's the customer culture, and I think everyone is fairly familiar with Nordstrom's customer culture, and it's internal as well. Everybody's considered a customer, and so teamwork was tantamount, and at Microsoft it's taken quite a bit to kind of energize that teamwork perspective, which is what led me to my other degree, which is I've recently got a master's degree in organizational psychology. So for me, about Microsoft, the thing that was challenging, love the technology, love understanding the business, but how the heck do we mobilize our workforce in such a way that we really, really go to the nth degree, and we make even bigger differences globally? And so that's what took me to the Center for Creative Change at Antioch University.
Wow. So what's the answer?
I'll tell you what the answer is. It's about building a foundation of trust, and from that collaboration comes. So, and collaboration leads to teamwork, leads to highly engaged teams, and optimizing your workforce. Sounds a little clinical, but it really can work.
And you've seen it in action here at Microsoft?
Oh, absolutely. I've seen it in action. When I was interviewed for the our Microsoft Insider, one of the things they asked me was, how did I end up with Jim Dubois' organization? And what led me there was I had done quite a bit of work around how do you build trust in organizations for my master's degree. And Jim was blogging on trust. And I tell you, it really gave me an insider's view to how somebody at the general manager level understands some of the foundational elements to a high-performance team and lives and breathes it. So I have seen it.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's good. So what do you enjoy about working at Microsoft?
I love the people, and I know that I should be saying first and foremost that it's the technology, but the people make the technology.
I agree.
Yeah.
And why don't we just start laying some technology off? Just kidding. I had to throw that in there.
Of course you did.
This isn't an HR commercial.
This is Carmine.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
Carmine, you're going to get us all in trouble.
Not
and
at all.
This will then be on YouTube.
Where's the trust? So what about the people? I mean, smart? I mean, were they challenging you? Like, what is it about the types of people that Microsoft tends to hire for and optimize for?
Well, I think we're changing what that looks like, and one of the things that really gets me excited is that we're focusing more on what it means to be diverse, and I think that that's the important shift, is there is the competitive engineering mindset, but now we're understanding that thinking different doesn't always mean that it isn't good, and that thinking different can actually make a big difference.
So, speaking, this is the Women in Technology series, specifically on Channel 9.
Yes.
And so, actually, the way that we found you was through that, I still want to say Micro News. I have no idea why they ever got rid of the name Micro News. They had
MSW Insider. Inside Track.
Micro News was better.
Yes.
I think
so. Stick with me with a brand that works. But anyway, that's either here or there. So you won an award recently, right?
I did. I won an award for the Women in Technology International organization. They're an outside group for leadership development for mentoring and empowering women.
So tell us more about that. Did you start an initiative here at Microsoft, or?
You know, it's one of those things where your passions sort of end up following you. And so I can't say that I've always been really energized about the topic of, you know, women and gender diversity. And especially when you work in a retail company and usually more than half of your employees are women. But when I came to Microsoft, suddenly there was a difference. And when you're 25 or 30% of the workforce, the environment feels different. So I kind of had a new insight into what it meant to be diverse. So I had the opportunity to work with Microsoft women's organizations, and so I've always done volunteer work. When I was in MSN, I did mentoring rings. And then, of course, when I came to IT, the first thing I did was try to find the women in IT organization and as usual, jumped in. Always opportunity to volunteer. And so then when I get into my master's program, I suddenly start to think, well, I'm looking at mobilizing workforces and social change. And I got language around how I was thinking and feeling. So I suddenly realized that I'm a social constructionist. And so it means that the way we develop our understanding of the world is how we live it and experience it. And everybody does it differently. So how does that impact the effectiveness of certain diverse groups? And in particular, I'm a woman in technology, and how does it affect us? And so I spent a couple of years doing research around, you know, what does it look like and what changes can we make? And so that brought me to an organization called Ignite, I-G-N-I-T-E, Inspiring Girls Now in Technology Everywhere. And what they do is they work on building the pipeline of young ladies to develop an interest in science, math, engineering, and technology. Mm-hmm. Well, and then here's where things start to attract each other. Ignite was also an organization that the women in IT have felt close with. Mm-hmm. So not only did I get the view from my master's program, but then I also got to do volunteers, so I got to see from the inside out what the differences were.
Yeah.
And then I learned about another organization. They're called Rural Development Institute, RDI. And what they do is they take the whole issue of gender to an even higher level, to a global level. And so they work in more of an intellectual area around land rights and land redistribution. But the reason it's gender interesting is that 80% of the population that receives their benefits are women. So they focus on women that are at the level of poverty. 1.2 billion people in the world subsist on less than a dollar a day. So all of a sudden I got this global understanding, and I got to the opportunity to look at things that were really significant in nature. And the passion has just continued to follow me. And through those sorts of things, I got an award.
Wow, congratulations. Sure.
Thank you.
Very nice.
I'm familiar with Ignite. I've actually spoken at some local schools to some young girls. And that's really important to me because I feel like we got to get them while they're young.
Yes.
And we have to make sure that they understand that technology is cool and not geeky or nerdy, mm-hmm. or something that, you know, the chess club or the math club does.
Yep.
And that it's ubiquitous in their life, and that, you know, it's really changing the culture.
Right. Absolutely it is.
I feel like college age is too late. Like,
you know, and even sometimes high school
even
is.
Even high school is.
And the other thing is that I don't think we've instilled in women yet that they can make a lot of money. And I got to tell you, the salaries in technology beat, you know, the salaries at McDonald's. So, you know, there's some other motivating reasons. And the other is that a lot of times when you take certain subjects, there's a natural ability, and I'm thinking like English or literature, where you can sort of develop that insight on your own, but you have to learn science, math, engineering, and technology, and that can be daunting for young women who haven't had the opportunity to understand what it's like to be coached or do sports teams, which is more natural for our young male population.
Interesting.
Yeah, so...
So you're definitely in the camp that believes that men and women are, you know, different in terms of DNA and how we think and how we...
Oh, absolutely. Science has proven that. So I don't know that I necessarily...
I don't know why. I keep denying it. I don't know why. Because I don't want to be different. I want to say that it's a level playing field. We all start, but we should embrace our differences. So talk about how that applies to the workplace.
So let me blow that up even bigger.
Please.
And say that, you know what? Everybody is different. And so if we can crack the nut for everybody, we crack the nut for what it means to empower women and diverse groups.
So it's not just about genders.
Correct.
Man versus woman.
Correct. And so some of the things that I learned and have experimented in are around, you know, what creates conflict and what doesn't. And so understanding how to change the dynamics changes it for everybody. And so one of the key reasons or key things that you can do is start by knowing that everybody comes in with different assumptions and different mental models. And that if you think about that, then having conflict is natural because you never come from the same place.
Right.
And so if you look at conflict like compromising or negotiating, it means that one party doesn't win. It means that somebody had to give something up. But what if you looked at conflict and you thought about it in turning it into an and situation, mm-hmm. and you look at people's fields of desires, and you solve for all of it. And I would like to say that in a lot of scenarios, you can solve for everybody's desires, and that it doesn't have to be an either or. And so it's that and. Mm-hmm. And that's what the key is.
And conflict doesn't have to be negative or really bad or something that friction filled that you fear or...
Yeah, so one of my favorite social scientists is a woman called Mary Parker Follett. And what Follett says is that, well, first off, conflict is natural, but you can be constructive of it. Mm-hmm. And so if you turn it into that and, what happens is my knowing changes and it expands and has now become bigger and we're integrated. Mm-hmm. And the result of that integration means that there's unity and those are the things that people get excited about in a collaborative environment. And it's from that unity that something really special emerges. Hmm. And that's the creative process. So it's the whole differentiation, mm-hmm. understanding what that is, mm-hmm. integrating that in such a way that now your field of vision is bigger, and then creativity takes over. And that is where Microsoft is going.
So I like it.
Interesting.
I want to be part of that culture, but I wonder if that's a little idealistic for corporate America. What do you think?
Absolutely not. Everybody wants to be successful. Everybody wants to do well. Everyone wants to feel good about what they do. But you have to build a basis of trust in order for that to start to happen. If I mistrust you, then the likelihood that I'm going to try to find out what your assumptions are just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So that's where the whole trust thing comes around. Isn't that funny how all this feeds in and mm-hmm. works together?
Mm-hmm. Totally. So, this is Pat. You're obviously very well educated on this. Why did you go back to school and get your master's to specialize in this?
Oh, so she asks me the really tough question. Okay, mm-hmm. So I will divulge a little bit more about my personal life. Okay. So I raised my single parent, raised my daughter, had a girl. My precious grew up and moved on to college. I met my second husband. He had a daughter. Suddenly, I am at a very young age in my life. I've got two girls, both of them in college, and I'm an empty nester. Well, you would think that I'd go back to school then, but unfortunately, they both decided on private colleges, so I had to wait. But if I were to be really honest and transparent, what really changed was I lost my mom. Mm-hmm. And I lost my mom 5 years ago, and I just knew that I needed to do something that would make her proud. Mm-hmm. So I went back to school thinking that it might kind of, you know, energize me a little bit more. And so then you have to decide, what program am I going to do? Well, should I get a master's in computer science? Should I get a master's in information technology? Should I do business? And then I thought, you know, after, you know, 20 years of experience, I've got strong technical aptitude. I wouldn't be here if I weren't. I've had a lot of jobs to develop my business acumen, so that's okay. But you know what the secret is? How do you mobilize your workforce? So that was what I went for, and that's why I went to the Center for Creative Change and took an organizational psychology degree.
And you earned your master's while you were working full-time?
Absolutely.
And you had full support from your management on that?
Not only did I have full support from my management, but I had full support from my husband. Mm. So I will say it was interesting to get a psychology degree, because I'll be honest and say earlier in my life I don't think I would have considered a social science interesting. But my husband, after about 9 months, did insist in reminding me that he was not getting a psychology degree, and that, in fact, I needed to quit trying things out on him.
And so this is something that you've been able to, not just in the world of an academic world, but take back to the workplace and really apply to your teams, the people you work with?
Absolutely.
And have they been receptive, or people think it's like gobbledygook?
I think you get all of the above, but where it really resonates is around trust. Who doesn't think trust is important, and who doesn't want to think that they think of themselves as being trustworthy? Right. And so if that's the foundation for building an organization and collaboration, that does resonate. And so, you know, schools offered me the opportunity to do research in trust and know what models look like, so that I do spend time in the organizations helping build content and context around the conversations, because otherwise it's kind of esoteric, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So it that part really gets people going.
Hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated.
Really?
Are you buying this, Mr. Engineer over there, developer dude?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Well, of course I am. I think actually, to be perfectly frank, I wish more managers, and I mean, your title actually is manager, right? I mean, you're manager of IT. I wish more managers really actually had sort of an understanding of psychology and the way humans interact, right? I mean, one thing that as a corporate culture, there's not always a lot of trust on a team because you're competing against your team members so that you can either keep your job or make more money or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's inherently, in corporate environment, there's inherently a certain amount of distrust, even if it happens implicitly.
Yes.
And so as a good manager, you'll know how to ensure that that doesn't really happen on your team.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd really love to know how you can ensure that the people that work on your team aren't mistrusting one another, especially in this current situation that we happen to be in. How do you deal with that?
I think you're going to find that there isn't a single team where there isn't an issue with trust, even in really high-performing teams. But I think that what you have to look at is how do you create a language around it? So how do you even talk about trust as a behavior? And the other is employing certain tools that make those conversations even more successful. Mm-hmm. And one of those tools is that you have to be self-aware. Mm-hmm. And the other one is feedback. And so if you have both of those mechanisms going on, then the whole trust conversation, it has an environment where it can foster and where people can then talk about what is it that's creating distrust and what can you do to build it. In the absence of it, then it's just a feeling that you have, and all you know is that that person isn't going to do something to help you along in your career.
So Carmine has alluded to the current environment. I mean, everyone knows that Microsoft has recently gone through, I think for the first time in its history, this volume anyway, of layoffs. Yeah. How does an employee trust its employer when in a situation like this? What is your advice on that?
Wow. Now you're asking for really big advice, and I think I should be charging you for that. You know, that really is leadership. And I'm hoping
starts at the top, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I'm hoping our leaders have enough self-awareness and enough empathy for what's going on in the world to be able to manage that in a way that's compassionate. And, you know, I think this is an opportunity for the company to realize that this is not a scenario we want to go through on a number of occasions anymore. Mm-hmm. And so how do we work towards not making that happen? Mm-hmm. But you're asking a good question, and I think there's going to take a certain amount of time to rebuild that trust.
And I think that, not that we get Microsoft gets a pass or anything, but we've never done this before, and I think some of our leaders have never been through this. And in this quantity, at least, and that it's their first time, and they're only human, and people are going to make mistakes. I mean, Microsoft's never done this before. I think this is the first time Steve Ballmer probably has had to, you know, do a press conference to kind of announce, you know, addressing Microsoft's layoffs. I think it's hard.
Absolutely. I mean, it's probably.
I think they're trying their best.
I don't want to ever be in that position.
Yeah.
So I think the whole question is how do you not put yourself in the position of being in this position?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't discount that it's not hard, and I don't discount that our leaders may not have experience in it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hope we don't have to get a lot of that.
Exactly.
Let's hope so. So in your job, but your job isn't focused on this. Like you're not like part of human resources or a group that's kind of like focused on organizational psychology, or I don't know what you would call it, but and you're doing an actual job, a day job kind of thing, but you're applying these techniques to your team and people. I mean, do you feel like that this is something that's important enough? Like we should have like people focused on this full time kind of thing and going in and working with groups and helping them?
I think that we should elevate the level of conversation for our folks that are leaders so that everybody can have similar opportunity and similar education. I don't think it's any big secret sauce, to be honest. It's about the amount of time you spend and about the dedication to trying it out and experimenting. But, you know, let's be real. The hardest part about, you know, exercising this stuff is the self-awareness and the feedback. So I think that's the biggest challenge for our leaders in general, not just at Microsoft, which is you have to, again, we get back to that learning organization, right? Everybody has to learn, including our leaders. So how do you build that in? But, yeah, I want to raise the bar. I don't think I should be unusual.
So can we talk a little bit about your experience as a woman at Microsoft? We all know that there are more men here than women. It's not the Nordstrom ratio.
No.
But what's that been like? I mean, how has it changed? Because I really do feel like Microsoft is really trying to become a different and better company over the years. And so can you talk about your experience as a female here?
Oh, yeah. Man, you know, there have been some groups that have been more challenging than others. And I think the whole key is the organization has to believe values and integrity are important. And I think that that's the big change that happened when Steve Ballmer and the groups of folks that built our value system. And fundamentally, that's been the most important change, which is, you know, accountability. What does honesty mean? What is integrity? And understanding what that looks like for the folks that are around the organizations that, you know, have low morale, you know, low poll scores. It's not just women. It's minorities, and it's a lot of guys, too. I think fundamentally it's the overall culture. And so maybe I was more sensitive to it because you could tell by talking to me, I'm not your typical engineer. So even being able to express my thoughts, you know, I had to really work very hard at having credibility and influence. I think the change that's happening is you don't have to work as much at credibility and influence. You have to work more at the content to make sure that you really are credible.
And do you feel like over the years, like certain behaviors are more acceptable or less acceptable than they have been? Like I remember, I've been at Microsoft for about 11 years too, and so I used to remember that like being the loudest person in the room was all that mattered. Literally. Exactly. But no matter how wrong they were. But that's really changed.
And it's changing even more so. So if you are introverted, we're training our managers to ask the introvert what's going on. So now it's not just everybody having to push stuff out. We're actually starting to pull things from people. And so, again, it's, you know, if you optimize 100% of the workforce, 100%, just think of what we would be able to be doing.
And we should be a reflection of our customer base.
We should be. But I don't hold out any illusions. I don't think Microsoft is going to be 80% women at any point in the near future.
But at least a bit of all the different. When I think of diversity, like you said, I don't think about just gender or different kinds of races. It's about diversity in thinking.
Absolutely.
Diversity in behavior.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the thing that I would look for more change in is I think there's, if not a perception, even a reality, where sponsorship at the leadership level actually works in empowering folks more. And I think we think a little bit and act a little bit too much like we're in the review process and there's a stack ranking. And sometimes that comes out in meetings and the way people are supported. And I've seen some managers really flip that bit. And they provide the same amount of support for the person who's at the bottom as the person who's at the top of their calibration. And it makes a huge difference. And I know that in the women's mentoring rings and in some of the women's organizations, for all of them, they feel that that's one of the things that can actually make a bigger change than anything else. And actually, I think there's some articles on it that have been written about recognizing voices in the room in and of itself changes influence and impact.
Interesting. So what does that mean? Does that mean, is it like, you know, you're only as strong as your weakest link, and so you can't just always optimize for your top performers, or that they're not always right? Is that what that mean?
No, not at all. It means that your top performers could be variable, and maybe they're at the bottom today, and they could potentially be at the top. And I'm not saying the, you know, the 80-20 rule, I'm not saying spend 80% on, you know, the folks that are on the lower side. What I'm saying is that it's really easy in meetings when someone who speaks up that isn't that top performer to say, good point. Or we've heard from everybody else, but Molly, we haven't heard from you. Suddenly people think, oh, what she says is important. And the other happens, right? I've been in meetings where women have been shut down. Now, it's not because they're a woman. It's because that's what that person is going to do. But their perception is that it's I'm because I'm a woman, and it's the perception of the other people, the other women in the room, too. So it takes 2 seconds to, you know, show that kind of appreciation for everybody on the team.
So what do you, I mean, do you talk about your role models? Who do you look up to? Who do you admire?
Wow. Gosh, that's a good question. I think probably the biggest role model in my life has been my mom. And she had those trite and true sorts of principles, but, you know, of people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And another one was always to walk in other people's shoes. And she trained us like that, and I can tell you it makes a really big difference in the quality of my life. But the other reality of role models is they're every single place in my life. They're women at Microsoft. They're women in the volunteer organizations that I work with. They're my sisters. They're my children. Mm-hmm. So everybody actually impacts me. I've met some really amazing women at Microsoft and a lot of amazing women in IT. Mm-hmm. Mary Jo Krutek is one of the best HR people I've met. Celia Morant Krause has always focused on sponsoring women and making sure that they make an impact. Susan Carmody is another woman who has always been in the workforce and is an engineer. There's just, I mean, I could just keep going on. I should stop, because if I don't mention somebody, I might get into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But do you find it hard to find female leaders at the very top in technology, not just Microsoft, but in technology?
There aren't very many, are there? So it's important to foster each other so that there do become more. I mean, there's a reality today, and that is that typically women who are at the VP, CIO, CEO level aren't in their 30s. And usually they're not even in their 40s. They're in their 50s and their 60s. There isn't anywhere to start cultivating that pipeline anymore. So if women are exiting and they're leaving the workforce, the opportunity for us to improve on that diversity is gone. So we have to be really conscientious, and we have to focus on retaining the women that we do have.
Mm-hmm. And that, I know that's been a big issue for Microsoft around females, mm-hmm. in particular, is retention.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I could throw research out. I could throw personal experience. I was somewhere where they were saying for HR that the reason most women leave for leaving is family reasons. But then they'll call them 6 months later to follow up, and they'll have already had another job. Mm-hmm. So I think fundamentally there is a perception that there is a glass ceiling and that it's really hard to break through. Microsoft is no exception to that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I would argue, just in the attempt at fairness, there's also glass ceilings for the males of the species at Microsoft as well. Because, you know, there are certainly males who work here that only get so far for any number of reasons. And I think it comes back to what you were talking about earlier, which is really important, and that's the notion of perception.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, not all cases, but in many cases, the superstars are perceived to be superstars. So
correct.
You've been tagged as superstar, but you really haven't done shit for a year. But you're still a superstar. We're going to put you up. You know, we know this person is typically not a high performer, comes to work, leaves early, stays, you know, maybe 8 hours. Whatever you manage your people do in your little, you know, glass houses. But what I'm saying is this is really interesting. And I usually perform pretty well, so I'm not trying to say that I'm getting things out. What I am saying, though, is that the notion of perception is really, really interesting. And I think that's male or female. Mm-hmm. We need to work on that. Like, you have to, good managers should just throw away last year's perceptions. Mm-hmm. And start afresh.
But isn't that where that whole behavior and treating everyone equally comes in?
Yeah.
Which is, that perception is reinforced all the time if people shut you down, if your manager never recognizes that your opinion is important. Mm-hmm. And so we do that stack ranking every single day, and you can't do that and be able to utilize your workforce 100%. Because, you know, if you're labeled as somebody who isn't a top performer, at some point you're going to sort of give up even trying to be a top performer.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a difference between everybody being phenomenal, mm-hmm. And having 20% of the company being phenomenal.
Agreed. So you guys are both managers, so this is interesting, because wouldn't you think that you did a better job managing your organization if your lower performers all of a sudden were rock stars?
Sure.
That should make you look better. That should be better for your career.
Not about us, but I mean,
I think it depends on what it really means to bring up the lower performers. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me ask you this question. What happens, given our review model, you know, 20-70-10, mm-hmm. if we do bring up all the lower performers and there isn't really that 10%.
I don't know. You tell me.
Where does it come from?
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's a part of the cycle and a part of not only the mystery of the performance management system, but also potentially if we're the best of the best, mm-hmm. even our 10% is in some other company 70 or 20.
Sure. Well, have you looked at have you, do you spend any time reading like mini Microsoft?
Yes.
Sure.
So we talked to, Ritzy and I had the pleasure of interviewing, what's her name?
Ariel Stallings.
Oh, but no, the Vice President of Human Resources.
Lisa Brummel. Yeah. Carmine.
Forgive me. So my point is, mini Microsoft, if you go there, I mean, unfortunately, it's interesting that we have to air our dirty laundry in that way, but what's really fascinating to me are the comments. Mm-hmm. Not really what Minnie's saying, although I think it's, you know, it's interesting. But you do notice that in the commentary, there's a lot of disgruntled employees. And
yes.
they're disgruntled about this, our review system. And so we tried to change it.
And what it embeds in our culture.
And what it embeds
in
our culture. Because
yes.
somebody who's operating at a lower level or a lower end, a manager should be responsible to figure out what's wrong with that person.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you have somebody
are they in the wrong
down
job?
There? Exactly. As
right.
opposed to, and we all know this is true, you have to have X number of people in the 10% range.
Yeah.
10% of your people, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So, to me, it's really interesting the kind of game that we play, because what you're talking about is, in some sense, academic.
Yes, I understand that.
Okay.
Yes, I get it. And that's where your sort of Pollyanna perspective mm-hmm. comes on. And it does impact what happens. That isn't lost on me.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it comes out every single day.
Mm-hmm.
I see it all the time. I know how people are stack ranked by the behavior in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've worked for companies where if you had attrition, the manager was responsible. And, I mean, we lose really good people all the time because they really don't want to put up with this kind of nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So
knowing that we can't boil the ocean, what can people like Charles and I and you do on a day-by-day basis? Assume, what for people who are ICs and not managers, what can they do?
You know, you're asking me a really tough question because I do think that the systems in the company do embed a certain amount of competition that could go awry.
Mm.
And the only thing I can do is answer that for myself. And I have succumbed to the traditional Microsoft qualities of competition and speaking louder. In fact, I can still do that today.
Good.
And I do think my answers are the best and I do know more. But the difference is I'm competing with myself. And the only person that I need to be accountable to is when I go home and I lay in bed at night and I worry about something. I don't want it to be because of something that I did that was wrong. I want it to be because I made a mistake.
Right.
You know, I want to feel free to make a mistake and to celebrate it. And so that's I've had enough years. That's the license that I give myself.
Hmm.
And the people that are around me, I offer that same license. Make the mistake. Let's mm-hmm. celebrate it. I want to know about it. It's one of the things I really enjoy about the new group that I'm in. One of the first meetings that we had, one of my managers said, you know, I'm holding myself accountable for this. And I was really impressed.
Wow.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Are you inspired? Thank you so much for talking
awesome.
To us today. This has been really interesting.
Good.
All right.
I think our viewers at home will enjoy it as well.
Absolutely.
So.
Nice close-up of Fritzy's head. That's cool. Look at the camera. Thank you. Take care.
Bye.